Court appointed is meant to be for entertainment purposes and basic legal information only.
Nothing in this podcast should be considered as legal representation nor legal advice.
Only use the knowledge presented herein to dazzle your friends or possibly win bar trivia.
Dude's perspective on legal frivolity. I'm your co-host, Mike Meadows. I'm a lawyer and a dude.
And I'm your other co-host, Tommy Schmerl. And I am just a dude.
Tommy, I feel like Christmas season is upon us.
It is upon us. Can you see my front yard?
I did.
And the inside of my house?
It is. You're very well decorated.
Yeah, we had the inside decorated prior to Thanksgiving, and now we got the outside decorated the day after Thanksgiving.
It's funny, when I came up to the house today, I commented that because your front yard now is pretty large. You have a big front yard.
Right.
And you have a ton of inflatables and things in there.
Yeah.
And you used to have, before you moved to this house, a very small front yard.
Very small. I could cut my grass in like 10 minutes.
Yeah. But basically, you still had the same amount of inflatables in that small yard.
Yeah. We believed in quantity over quality.
I don't know. Those are some quality inflatables.
Why, thank you. I like our hot air balloon Santa that we just added to the mix.
That is a new one.
We had to replace our snow globe. It lasted like 15 years.
Oh, the Mickey snow globe?
Well, no, not Mickey. It had a snowman and it had a Christmas tree in the middle and a snowman on one side and Santa on the other. Hmm. And it blew the snow around inside. You know those ones that have the styrofoam like little balls and it blows it around in there? And it used to light up and it doesn't light up anymore. And then it also, it's a very heavy one, so it was hard for it to stay inflated. So now it's got a little bit of a hole here, a little bit of a hole there. And it's just enough where Santa and the snowman were both laying in the snow face down inside.
Yeah,
so it looked like they were dead. Yeah, or something. You know, they'd been drinking or they'd been shot and mistaken for deer. I don't know. So anyway, they looked a little drunk. So we replaced them. We thought about putting them somewhere back in the yard, but we thought, nah, that'll be miserable. We'll just retire him.
Yeah, retire them.
We retired him into the basement.
There you go. Well, with the holidays coming up and everybody having all their family in visiting and in-laws in visiting, I figured it would be very topical to talk about divorce.
Yeah, because that's the cause of a lot of them, huh?
It can be. It is the season for divorce.
Yeah.
But actually, there is quite an uptick during the holiday season in domestic issues that pop up. Usually, it's in the like modification of different divorce decrees and things like that, with people arguing about when children are going to be able to visit during the holidays and things like that. You do generally see an uptick in that kind of litigation. But we haven't actually done an episode, I don't think, on just flat-out divorce. So
I don't know. I would have to look. I don't have that long of a memory. I think I remember what we did last week, but beyond that, it's all a haze.
Well, all the great ones, they say they have a short memory.
That's right. I think that, though. I think that's like for cornerbacks and stuff.
And goalkeepers. When you think about divorces, and you think about people going through divorces, it is a very emotionally charged and hotly contested area. And a lot of people say, a lot of lawyers say at least, that it's good people going through pretty much the worst time of their lives. And that's the way you kind of have to look at it as an attorney, that when people are kind of very much on edge and very short, that it's actually probably not that person who they normally are, but they're going through a really, really rough time.
Well, that's what I read a quote that said, criminal lawyers work with the worst people in their best behavior, and family lawyers work with the best people on their worst behavior.
That's true. It is very true. And also, I was going to talk about it a little bit later. We can go and get into it now. Family law, being a lawyer, is actually probably the most dangerous law you can practice. The amount of family lawyers that get assaulted and killed and murdered, I mean, it's much higher. When you think about it, you think, oh, being a criminal law is kind of dangerous. No, it's family law.
Mm-hmm.
Criminal lawyers usually are pretty happy with their lawyers for the most part.
Well, they're there trying to defend them.
Yeah.
Trying to get them off. Even if they're guilty, they're trying to get them off. So.
Yeah. But family lawyers are usually the butt of a lot of anger and ire.
Yeah. Because you have to get nasty in those things.
Well, you don't have to. And that's the thing.
Well, the good ones do. That's the problem. The ones that are considered the best ones, it's because they do that. They do that.
Well, I don't know. I mean,
it's their duty.
I think that you can be a tough lawyer in those situations. I don't think you have to get nasty. And I think that's kind of a common misconception that somebody, they go into these things thinking they want somebody who's going to fight for them and be tough and whatever. But really, when that lawyer goes in there and fights for them and is tough and argues every small little point, that lawyer is making money arguing every small little point.
Yeah.
So you're paying for that.
Yeah, I read a lot of examples of that type of stuff. Yeah. The problem is, a lot of the times people are in situations where they are so spiteful towards the person they're divorcing, they don't care about the money.
Yeah.
All they want is that revenge factor or that spite factor or whatever it is. So
yeah.
They're not thinking with reason.
That's true. I read a study basically said, depending on, which one you read, about 50% of marriages end in divorce. So it's quite a few. So the divorce business as an attorney is booming.
And when you talk about stress, there's the three most stressful things I think I read in your life is a death of a loved one, a divorce, or the loss of your job.
Yeah.
I mean, it doesn't get much more stressful than that. Those are about your three most stressful things.
And it's actually, divorce can be pretty expensive too, depending, especially if you want to litigate every little issue. It can also be not too bad either if you agree with your spouse and you can work things out. But a lot of times you have trouble agreeing with your spouse. That's pretty much why you're getting divorced.
Yeah. So that the money part is, coined the phrase, it's cheaper to keep her.
Yeah. Well, a lot of people say, they ask the question, why is it so inexpensive to get married, but it's more expensive to get divorced? And they say, because it's worth it.
So, yeah, that's right.
That's one way to look at it.
But you talk about you're splitting up a household.
Yeah.
So now where you had one house and one set of furniture and one set of utility bills, now you got two houses and two sets of furniture and two utility bills. So no wonder that it's expensive, you know?
Yeah, and each state has different laws regarding divorce and how they go about breaking it down. So again, I always like to preface this by saying anything we talk about here is going to be kind of just general overview. So,
because each state's a little different.
Each state's totally different. And, this is one of those things where if you have questions about stuff like this, you should always go talk to a lawyer. That's my disclaimer again, even though we have one at the beginning.
How much do they pay you to say that? They all chip in. Hey, Mike, tell them to all call us. Don't give them any advice.
No, it's more like what I don't have to pay my malpractice carrier when I get sued for giving
podcast advice. Hey, if you were dumb enough to listen to me, you deserved what you got.
Yeah. This is for bar trivia. We've already discussed this.
That's right. We're drunk most of the time anyway. Don't listen to us.
West Virginia in particular, and this again varies by state, has special family courts that hear only basically domestic issues, like divorce. The family courts are kind of like courts of limited jurisdiction, and they actually derive their authority from circuit courts, which is our general jurisdiction courts. And actually, circuit courts in West Virginia used to hear domestic matters back in the day, but it became such a burdensome thing on the courts, they decided to carve it out and split off these family courts just to hear the family issues, so the circuit court could focus on criminal law and other civil issues.
Well, I would imagine right now, as hard as the opioid epidemic has hit our state, that the family courts are even heavier with cases than they were when family courts were first thought of.
Well, they are, but a lot of times when you get into the opioid type things, you're talking about abuse and neglect, where children have been abused or neglected.
Right.
And actually, those cases fall under the jurisdiction of circuit court. So they don't.
Well, I was thinking of custody more or less too.
Well, yeah.
There's a lot of custody things because look how many grandparents are raising kids now because of that.
Now you can do guardianship through family court, and a lot of times when people have addiction issues, they'll give guardianship to their parents, basically the grandparents, to raise the kids. And there's dual jurisdiction in there, which kind of stems from the fact that the jurisdiction arises from circuit court. You can file for a guardianship in circuit court or in family court. But if you file an action in family court and there's any kind of instances of abuse or neglect or anything that might be abuse and neglect that like Child Protective Services might investigate,
right,
the family court judge has a duty to refer that over to circuit court. So that's called a crossover case because the circuit court is the one who has a jurisdictional about abuse and neglect.
Oh, okay.
And that's the kind of case where somebody actually might get their rights terminated. Whereas in family court, they could just basically say they can't terminate rights. All they could do is basically say you can't see your kids. So that would be kind of the difference there.
So you're not terminated. You just can't see them. They're,
pretty much.
We're going to make them invisible.
Yeah. Yeah. Invisible kids. I kind of went on a little bit of a tangent there talking about that. But.
Well, I think I misled you there when I said what I said. So it kind of took you off on that tangent.
Well, you have a tendency to do that.
Yes, I do. It's because I have a hard time staying focused on any one thing.
Now, the appeals from family court in West Virginia do go to the circuit court. And they actually have cameras in all the family courts where they record it so you can actually watch a video of it. And that was when I was a clerk for a circuit court. That was one of my main jobs, was to review these videos and watch them and help the judge make a decision on the appeal on the different issues.
Hmm.
So,
well, some of them, I bet they wish there weren't cameras in the court, like that one that we had where that guy was yelling at the other guy.
Oh, yeah.
That one judge just went nuts yelling at the defendant and everything and calling him all kinds of names and all that kind of stuff. And he ended up getting, like, disbarred or something like that.
Yeah. I mean, it's kind of crazy lawyers would actually even act that way. But
yeah.
Family court judges here in West Virginia hear cases involving divorce, annulment, separate maintenance, paternity, grandparent visitation, issues involving allocation of parental responsibility, and family support proceedings. Like I said, except those incidental to child abuse and neglect proceedings. Family court judges also hold final hearings in domestic violence and civil proceedings as well. So if there's a domestic violence case, they hear the final hearing on that. The way that works in West Virginia with family court and these domestic violence petitions is that you actually apply with the magistrate, which is our lowest court, for a temporary injunction for domestic violence. And you basically plead your case to the magistrate pro se, meaning the other side's not there. You just say, here's why I need this right now. The magistrate makes a determination, and then within 10 days, there'll have to be a final hearing in front of the family court judge. So,
but you can get it right away, though, with the magistrate?
You can get it right away.
That's good.
So immediately.
Yeah, because that delay can mean the difference between life and death.
Yeah, and then if in 10 days they have the final hearing, and then that family court judge can extend it or say, you know what, I don't think this really meets the criteria, I'm going to dismiss it or whatever. So, but now to get back to dividing the property up, because that's kind of the main thing about divorces.
That's right.
You got stuff and you got kids.
And you always think about it as the wife gets everything and the husband gets nothing.
Oh, really? Is that how it goes?
He goes into the apartment while the wife stays there in the house and has the kids, and you have to pay her money to live there and everything.
He sits on a sad couch with his TV sitting on phone books.
Yeah, and you got like aluminum foil on your rabbit ears so that you can pick up 2.5 channels.
Yeah. Him and his cop partner who's about to retire then ends up getting shot by the end of the movie.
Oh, I didn't know this was a movie.
I think you've hit on every trope there possibly could be right there. But no, actually, that's not how it generally goes.
Really?
No.
I thought that was the way it went.
Now, there's two different theories about how property...
That's why I stayed married for 40 years. I didn't want to be in a sad couch.
Joke's on you.
Mary, we got something to discuss.
You wanted to be on the sexual couch.
Yeah, not the sad couch.
I'm sorry, sectional couch.
She won't let me get a sexual couch.
I'm glad. I wouldn't want to sit on your sexual couch.
Well, apparently you get in trouble if you have one of those.
Yeah, they're really expensive.
Yeah, they cost you your job as a Supreme Court justice.
If you haven't listened to our previous podcast or previous episodes of our podcast talking about the Supreme Court debacle here in West Virginia, the couch was a big part of it and why the justices got in trouble. So.
And Michael's phrasing of sectional sometimes gets a little lazy and it sounds more like sexual.
So the different ways you can divide property, and these are two different theories. One is called community property, and the other is called equitable distribution. So those are the two basic theories. Community property is basically a minority view. It is basically that most property that is acquired during marriage, except for gifts or inheritance, is owned by both spouses. So basically...
If you go out and buy a couch, you both own the couch.
Right, but it gets a bit more complicated than that, because that would be the same in equitable distribution, too. Basically, under community property, there is a presumption that everything should be split 50-50. So there's no other real determination. There's no other equitable type look at it. It's just basically everything is split.
Okay.
And that concept originated in civil law jurisdictions, but it's actually found in some common law jurisdiction as well. And really, if you look at a map as to where it is, it's primarily in the Western United States, and it was kind of derived from Mexico's community system, which was inherited from the Spanish law, which actually was derived from Roman law. So it kind of, you can trace that.
Wow.
That area from there. So you kind of have Roman law to Spanish law to Mexican law to the borders along the Mexican U.S. border there. So that's kind of where the community property theory exists.
So it came across before there was a wall there.
That's right. The wall did not keep it out, much like it would not keep out anything, I don't think. But
just like that ex-president down there said, we have a secret weapon to thwart your wall. It's called a ladder. We're going to make a damn ladder.
And I actually don't have much experience with community property because I've never lived or practiced in any states that have that. I'm admitted in West Virginia and Florida, and both of those are equitable distribution states, as is the majority of most of the United States. So, again, community property is definitely the minority approach.
All right. So to sum up community property, it's a 50-50 split of all the assets.
Exactly. And everything is presumed to be 50-50.
So it doesn't matter how it came into the marriage. It's there. So it's 50-50.
Well, it can matter how it came into the
marriage. Inheritance and something else you said.
Gifts. Things like that.
Yeah.
But basically, pretty much it's all supposed to be split. There are some limited exceptions.
All right. So then what would you sum up equitable distribution?
That's right. Equitable distribution, only marital property is considered for property division, and only those assets that are considered for it must have been acquired during the course of that marriage. So things like the marital home, bank accounts, investments, businesses, in some places, educational degrees and things like that are considered marital property. And basically, the resolution of the divorce will involve splitting up those different items in an equitable fashion. So whatever is equitable. And it gives the judge much more discretion to make a determination about what is equitable or what is fair, basically. What is fair and just.
So are you saying, like, say that you the guy owned his house before he married.
Right.
All right, then they get married. Whatever time later, they get divorced.
Yep.
So you're saying that through equitable distribution, that he has a better chance of saying, hey, this was my house before we got married. I'm keeping my house.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean,
whereas under community property, she's entitled, you're going to have to buy out her share or negotiate or something.
Yeah. Now, there could be some exceptions. Different states have different laws saying if that was their marital home, then it will be split regardless of who came into it.
Oh, okay.
So that could be an exception. But if you had like rental property and it, one person kept it, I think you'd almost definitely say that's non-marital property. But there could be an exception to that, and I'll get into that. So the way I learned this in law school.
Oh, a teaser, eh?
A teaser. Now, the way I learned this in law school, I like to call the three-pot theory.
Three-pot, and it end up you don't have a pot to pee in.
So basically, the theory goes like this. You have one big pot sitting in front of you. And everything that you own, whether it's like your name, your spouse's name, it doesn't really matter. It doesn't
matter.
Dog's name. Doesn't matter who bought it. It doesn't matter who says they own it or who worked for it or who whatever. You just put everything in there before any arguments are made. Mm-hmm. So everything goes into the main big pot.
Okay.
That's the main pot.
Okay.
Then
the main pot.
Then you split out. You have a spouse one pot and spouse two pot.
Mm.
So you take the separate property out and give it back to the spouse that it belongs to, and you basically leave only the marital property in the first pot so you can divide that later. So that's where you make your arguments about what is and what's not marital property. So if something was inherited, if something was a gift, you know, if they owned it before they got married, then it would not be in that main pot. That gets split out first.
What about clothing? Could you say that clothing is yours, even if you bought it during the marriage? I mean, if
you can, assuming it was marital funds which purchased it.
I mean,
if
somebody else wanted, whichever way, wanted the other one's clothing, that would just be in spite. That wouldn't be a useful thing.
Well, if it was equitable, if basically marital funds were used to purchase it and there was such a discrepancy in the value of it that the only way to make it fair and reasonable was to give that person half part of that. I mean,
I want half of your dresses and half of your shoes.
Now, the teaser I said was basically it can be kind of tricky if the asset was actually sufficiently commingled with marital assets. So what I mean by that is, like I teased about, like a spouse who owned a house free and clear before the marriage. So most likely that would not be marital property because they owned it before the marriage. It wasn't then it's owned free and clear. Mm-hmm. They're not paying a mortgage on it. They might pay taxes and things on it from marital funds, but not really.
Right.
Not a lot.
In essence, they owned it already.
They owned it. Yeah. So that probably would not be marital property. That would go in one of the separate spouse pots. But here's the catch. say during the course of the marriage, they decide, you know what, we want to put an addition on that rental property. And then they use marital funds and mm-hmm. put on, or say the deck or something, anything that really increases the value.
A
swimming pool. Absolutely a swimming pool. They increase the value using marital funds. At that point, the marital funds have become so commingled with that premarital asset that it kind of transforms into a marital asset.
Wow, it's like magic.
It's like magic.
It transformed it.
Yeah. Same thing can be said with inheritance, too. Unless you're very diligent and you keep, like, say you get $50,000 from your grandmother in June, and then you get married in September, then basically, if you keep that money in a separate account the entire time, it's very easy to say, well, hey, this was separate the whole time. If you put it in a shared bank account, then you pay bills out of it, and then you buy a house, and then you sell the house, and it loses its premarital glow of it.
The premarital glow, huh?
That's right. Huh.
That's what she said.
Another thing too is like if your mother gave you an antique piece of jewelry, that would actually come out of the pot earlier and go back to you. Gifts like that, mm-hmm. somebody gave specifically to you. So then basically what happens once you carve all that kind of stuff out, the judge takes all that property in the main pot and they put a value on it. They say, okay, what is everything worth? So what are all these clothes worth? I mean, they would actually go and do that if it gets down to that kind of minutia. The judge looks at that price and they say, okay, here's what we're going to do. And they look at it from the date of the separation as well. So like if you have different assets that have increased or decreased, it doesn't matter. It basically goes pretty much from the date of separation generally. Mm-hmm. So that's the bright line when you make the determination about what the value is.
So if you went out and bought a new car after you separated, like that wouldn't be in the mix, even though you were still married.
Here's the thing. If you did that, it would be presumed that you used marital funds to do that.
Oh.
So it would have to go back into the marital pot. And if you wanted to keep that car, you would have to actually take the value of that as part of your equity. So you understand what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And it's like that with debt.
So don't buy a new car until it's final.
Yeah. Well, it's like that with debt as well. Debt's equitably split up too.
Now, that's what the husband gets in the divorce. He gets the debt. She gets all the assets and he gets the debt. That's the way it's an equitable divorce works.
Sure.
I've always heard.
I've actually never seen that in an order.
That's the way I've always heard. That's why I've been married for 40 years.
But the judge takes all in consideration, the value, and tries to make an equitable split based upon that. So that is, in essence, equitable distribution. So as you can see, I know a lot more about equitable distribution than I do community property.
Could that be because in your two divorces, that's what was taking place?
And also, it's practiced law in two states that had that.
Oh, okay. So you have in-depth experience and firsthand experience.
That's right. And as I said, the judge will basically divide it in half. If you let it go to a final hearing, the judge makes a determination. Now,
the wisdom of Solomon.
In some instances, now they won't split things up. They won't essentially carve it in
like
half.
Like twins.
Yeah, they won't.
They won't split up the twins.
Exactly. They'll attribute the value of one entire asset to somebody and then try to offset that with the value.
You get half the pool table and you get half the pool table. Get the chainsaw out here.
Exactly. No, I love that pool table. Then it is yours. But if you come to an agreement with your spouse, which I said you can do, then you don't have to make a judge make a final determination. Mm-hmm. And in my experience, because I did have two prior divorces.
Then, you did?
Yeah.
I never say anything about that, so I didn't know.
You just said it.
Oh, yeah. I forgot. Remember, I forget a lot.
You donkey. But anyway, I was able to come to an amicable agreement with both of my prior spouses, and we never had a final hearing. We split everything up ourselves and said, you take this, I take that.
Well, you're a lawyer. You don't want to pay another lawyer to do what you could already do, huh?
Yeah, and it's like, you know, it was pretty reasonable. It's like, yeah, we shouldn't be together anymore.
Just threw everything in her pot.
That's right. I'll take the sad couch.
Yeah, I know. Now that sad couch is in my basement.
Well, your cat peed on it. That's why it's still here.
And it's missing a leg.
It's true. I don't know if your cat did that or not. I can't prove it.
No, it did a lot of things, but it didn't did make the leg fall off.
So that's basically how you split property. But there's a lot more that goes into divorce other than just that.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. Sometimes people have kids.
Well, that's true. Sometimes people do. It has been known to happen.
It has been known to happen. When you have kids, you have to come up with some sort of parenting plan as well. And basically that's for children who are under 18. And that's kind of like where the children will stay during the week, and who gets visits when, who gets what holidays, and this and that, those kinds of things. You also have child support, basically who's going to pay support to the other parent. You make a determination about who is a custodial parent, who makes the decisions, and also who's able to claim the child is dependent on taxes.
Oh, yeah.
So that kind of is something that is taken into consideration as well. So
you can't both claim them.
No, you can't. So you want to make sure if you do have a divorce that you get all that kind of stuff incorporated in there, because when you don't have everything in it, that's when it leads to couples coming back to court trying to get some sort of determination about these things.
Well, there's a very famous one that's getting ready to go to court. Supposed to be, I think, either this week or next week.
Who's that?
Brangelina.
Are they going back to court?
Yeah, they're supposed to be in court. They were trying to get it settled before, but their court date was either the end of this week or early next week.
Oh, really?
Yeah, they're supposed to go in and they're supposed to do the final judgment or whatever.
I thought they were already done.
They're done, but they didn't have the final decree hasn't been issued yet.
Oh.
So
do they have an agreement, or they're going to actually have a judge make a decision?
The judge is going to make a decision. They can't come to an agreement. That's what they're trying to do, is come to one without the judge deciding it.
Well, even if you do come to an agreement, you basically have to go back in front of the judge and put the agreement on the record, and the judge has to make a finding that the parties are doing it under their own volition and nobody's making them do it and things like that.
Well, that's what I mean. They were trying to do that with each of their own lawyers, but apparently they're having quite a squabble over some assets and the children. She wants sole custody, I think, of the children.
Yeah.
And he wants joint custody.
You can actually come to an agreement on some issues and go ahead and let the court enter an order on that, and then litigate different issues too. So really, if you can kind of narrow down the issues you have to fight about, that's always a good course of action as well. It makes it more simple. So yeah, we have basically child support, custodial parents, things like that. And then there's another issue that pops up too.
Teaching the parent to say bad things about the other person?
No, that is not one of the things.
Well, did you see that, though?
Yeah.
The lawyer had to negotiate that, but that they were each evidently teaching the parent to say bad things about the other one, so they had to put in the decree that they would not teach their parent to do that. Now, I never got divorced, but I could have used that against Mary. I don't know if you remember, but after Mary and I first got married, we got a small parakeet that we named Ashley.
Yeah.
Remember Ashley?
Yeah.
And Ashley, I don't think Mary deliberately taught Ashley, but Ashley picked up on his own, "Damn it, Tommy! Damn it, Tommy!"
I remember that. "Damn it, Tommy!"
And it would sit there over in the corner talking to the wall going, "Damn it, Tommy! Damn it, Tommy!" I didn't know if it was the bird or Mary, because it was familiar.
Yeah, I remember Ashley doing that. That's funny.
Yeah, we should have put that bird in jail, though. Did you remember that it ended up murdering the mate that we got for it? And we got Ashley was a green parakeet, and Mary decided it was lonely and needed a mate, so we got a blue female parakeet and put it in there, named it Abby.
Oh,
so
yeah.
It was Ashley and Abby.
Yeah.
And from the time we put Abby in the cage with Ashley, Ashley would not say anything, wouldn't do anything, just stood there with his head down the whole time. Apparently, he did not like Abby.
Yeah.
And Abby would just chirp and jump around and do all kinds of stuff. Well, you know, every night before they go to bed, we would cover them up.
We
put the cover over so they could sleep.
Yeah.
And then you take it back off the next day. We took it off the next morning, just after having Abby for a couple months. And Abby was lying dead in the bottom of the cage. And Ashley was just chirping away, singing.
Happy as can be.
Happy as can be. And Abby, I mean, we couldn't swear to it. We didn't have any DNA evidence or anything, but it looked like she had peck marks all over her body. So I think he pecked her to death.
Really?
Yeah.
So he was a pecker, huh?
Yeah, he was a real pecker. He was a real parakeet pecker.
So Lewis Frimble was the one who put that on our Facebook page about that thing. I had to look it up because I forgot. Yeah, about the not teaching a parrot to say dirty words.
So, it's hard to do sometimes. There's a joke about that, but I can't. It's too long and involved.
Sometimes marriages are too. The other thing I was going to talk about.
You got to end them quick sometimes.
Yeah, definitely. Is spousal support or alimony.
Which
that comes into play. Usually for longer term marriages, more than 10 years is kind of the general basic principle you look at. If it's a marriage longer than 10 years, there could be a question of alimony or spousal support. So they'll always look at the ability to pay and the need for the spouse to have it. So the classic example is if one of the spouses worked and the other stayed at home and took care of the kids and the house and didn't really try to advance their career because they were busy keeping the house and taking care of that, that is their contribution to the marriage. Mm-hmm. And it wouldn't be equitable or wouldn't be fair for them to be punished in the future because their future earning capacities would be less because they haven't advanced their career.
Right.
So in that instance, that's where you have the theory for alimony. So the term alimony actually comes from the Latin word alimonia, which basically means nourishment or sustenance, interestingly enough.
Mm-hmm. Gives you enough to live off of.
That's right. And there's actually, citing all the way back to the Code of Hammurabi, which we've talked about before.
Yeah.
And it declares that a man must provide sustenance to a woman who has borne him children so that she can raise them. The actual way it reads, it says, if a man wished to separate from a woman who has borne him children or from his wife who has borne him children, then he shall give that wife her dowry and a part of the usufruct of field, garden, and property so that she can rear her children. When she has brought up her children, a portion of all that is given to the children, equal as that of one son, shall be given to her. She may then marry the man of her heart.
Oh, got to raise the kids first, though?
Yeah.
Oh. Huh.
So focus on the kids, then marry a man of your heart.
Wow.
I don't know. But anyway, I think it's kind of interesting that the theory goes back that far, that even in the Code of Hammurabi, it was said, hey, you know what? This isn't fair.
So. Yeah, and then out of alimony, you also had all those famous cases that came about for palimony, where they weren't actually married, but they separated, and then the person still sued for part of the property and for, you know, spousal support or whatever, even though they weren't their spousal.
Yeah. So child support obviously goes to the children. Spousal support or alimony goes to the spouse. Pretty clear. Spousal support is always waivable. So it's one of those things that you can actually just say, I'm not interested. I don't want it. The court doesn't have to award it. And generally you have to usually you have to fight for it unless the other side says, I recognize that you're probably going to get it anyway. So I'll go ahead and concede that point and give you whatever amount. Child support is generally not waivable though. So because really in theory, it's the child's support. You can't waive that on right. behalf of the child. Although some states I do believe allow it in some form. They have some kind of workaround where you're allowed to waive child support, but for the most part, you can't waive child support. It's going to be ordered.
Maybe if the person that has the children proves that they don't really need it, that they can take care of the children all right, then maybe that's how you get around it.
No, not really, because the presumption is that the child should not have to suffer from the effects of the divorce. So mm-hmm. if a child is used to having two incomes, then the child should still get two incomes.
Well, what I was thinking is, what if for whatever reason, say the husband was working and the wife was at home and the husband is awarded custody of the children, then you're still going to make the wife pay child support, even though she wasn't working at the time that the divorce took place?
She would have to pay some. It would be based upon her ability to pay.
Really?
Well,
if she doesn't work, her ability to pay?
Even if it's a nominal amount, they'll impute minimum wage of 40 hours a week.
Wow.
Because she could work.
That'd be rough.
But she doesn't have to pay all of it. I mean, it's based upon a percentage, and it's mm-hmm. not a lot. But just because, you know, and if she doesn't get any custody, and then basically she should have to pay the husband. It doesn't matter mm-hmm. because she should have to support her kids. That's one of the tenets of our society. Take care of your children. It's actually, when we're talking about abuse and neglect in the court system, failure to provide for your children financially or emotionally, for that matter, is grounds for abuse and neglect. And you can get your parental rights terminated for that. So.
See, I'm just old-fashioned in thinking about that. I always think that the woman gets the kids uh-huh. and the guy gets the bills and pays the child support and stuff. And when you get into situations where it's the other way around, it just doesn't seem right. Like that whole Kevin Federline getting paid, taking Britney Spears back to court to sue her for more. He needs $250,000 a month or something like that, you know, whatever. It's just because she's making good money. He decides he needs more, you know. To me, that's just not right.
Well, Yeezys aren't cheap. You gotta get those shoes. So.
isn't easy being Yeezy.
Talking about alimony, though, and I thought this was kind of interesting, so I'll talk about this. There's actually different kinds of alimony. You have separation alimony, and that's alimony that is usually ordered to pay if the couple is separated and one is unable to be self-sufficient during the separation. And then basically if they reconcile, the alimony may be stopped. So that's one of those things they kind of give right away. It might even be like temporary. So rehabilitative alimony is alimony where one partner is not self-sufficient again, And this may be ordered kind of temporarily until they can find some way to care for themselves or the children and support themselves. And it's actually something that is kind of generally set for, well, we're going to give you a rehabilitative alimony, which we're going to review in 90 days. And we're going to see where it goes from there or something like that. So it kind of keeps coming back to court.
Can that be like tuition to like to go back to school and finish a degree or something? It could. Like that?
And if you were presenting a case for rehabilitative alimony, you might say, Your Honor, I'm arguing for rehabilitative alimony. My client has 2 semesters left until they will finish their degree, at what time they'll be able to earn a salary. So therefore, I would ask for 12 months rehabilitative alimony. And the judge may say, it sounds reasonable. So, and they may order it.
And if Jehoshaphat was doing it, Your Honor, I pray upon the court.
I hope nobody was squatting when Jehoshaphat made that appearance. Who's our listener that said that?
Yeah, it said he was squatting 296 pounds.
Something like that.
Something like that. He said that he almost dropped it on himself or something. I was going to say, I don't talk about squatting on the radio.
Squatting on the radio?
Yeah, squat. We'll get one of those squatty potties.
It can be hard for you to squat in the radio. A lot of sound effects going on there. Permanent alimony is the kind that you're probably thinking of, where basically you're going to pay the spouse this amount forever until one of you dies.
Or at least as long as you're rich and making hundreds of millions, huh?
That's right. And you can, I'll get into some other things about these different kinds of support here in a minute. But reimbursement alimony, where basically if you paid to help put a spouse through college or school or something like that, they can order to say, hey, you're going to reimburse them for this amount for whatever the tuition was or for whatever it was to pay for the room and board during that time when you went to school. And then there's lump sum where basically they say, well, lump sum alimony is that it's fair for me to give a disbursement of $30,000 as alimony. And that'll be it. Mm-hmm. So now there's other things that can go on into family law, which we haven't really talked about and probably don't have time to today, but prenuptial agreements, postnuptial agreements. And then
we actually talked about those before.
We did, but I meant in the context of today's thing. Oh. Those can basically change all these different things we just talked about. If you have an agreement in place beforehand, it can change this different kind of distribution and disbursements. Mm-hmm. The other thing I was talking about with regard to this different kinds of support with like alimony or child support is that if there's been a change in circumstance, then you can actually petition the court to change that. So like if you, through no fault of your own, lost your job and can't afford to pay that anymore, you no longer have the ability to pay. So therefore, the court generally will modify it. Now, it can't be something where you intentionally go out and quit your job and go get a minimum wage job and say, well, I can't pay anymore. The court's going to say, too bad, you did that to yourself. Mm-hmm. You know, your child shouldn't have to suffer. You can't do that to be spiteful.
Same way if you get a better job or a promotion and a raise and you have to pay more?
It very rarely goes up, because the reason being is that it's whatever the children are kind of accustomed to. So basically, you want the children to kind of keep the same lifestyle they had before the divorce.
Because I've gotten reviews like from other states that would send in to me that I had to send back what kind of money a person was making that was paying child support. And if they're making more money than they were before, a lot of times they send me back a thing saying you have to do it because based on a percentage of what they make.
Yeah, well, that's true. I mean, it depends too. I'm thinking like in larger case divorces, like with more money, it's very rarely it goes up. This is usually where people are paying like $25 a month. They're paying the bare minimum.
Right.
And then they get a better job.
Yes,
and
so or a raise or something.
Yeah, it's actually not really enough to support their child. It's just kind of the bare minimum. Then at that point, yes, it can go up.
Yeah.
But for the most part, I was thinking of in the context of like, we're talking KFED, Brangelina. Mm-hmm. You know, they're not going to increase child support.
No, I mean, if a guy's making $400 a week and he's paying 60 of that in child support, he's only got 340 left to live on, you know?
Yeah. It's a sad couch.
That's right. That's why you got the sad couch.
And again, with all these things too, you can actually come to an agreement and kind of not have to fight about it, not have attorneys fight about it. Because really, when you fight about all these different kinds of things in a divorce, the only person, the only people that come out ahead are the attorneys.
Lawyers, yeah.
Because they're making the money on the hourly basis. Yeah,
they're making, what is it like, the going rate, $525 an hour or something like that?
Oh, no, not
around here. $525 an hour?
Not around here.
Isn't that what it is?
It can vary, but
I thought it was about like that.
I don't think anybody around here makes $5.25 an hour.
So. I read this one story. Said this guy was going home one evening and realized that he had forgotten his daughter's birthday. So he drove to the mall and ran in the toy store. And he asked store manager, he said, how much is that new Barbie in the window? And the manager said, which one? And he said, We have the Gym Barbie. That one's 1995. We have Ball Barbie for 1995. We have Shopping Barbie for 1995. Beach Barbie for 1995. And Divorce Barbie for $375. And he said, why is the Divorce Barbie $375 when all the others are $19.95? And the manager said, well, Divorce Barbie comes with Ken's car, Ken's house, Ken's boat, Ken's dog, Ken's cat, and Ken's furniture.
Further playing into your trope that you said earlier. That doesn't sound very equitable.
You don't think so?
No.
Well, Ken's on the sad couch. Ken's on the
sad. You can get the Ken doll with the sad couch.
That's right.
And the TV on a stack of books.
Yeah. And the sexual couch won't do him any good because he's smooth down there.
I got nothing. I don't know.
Neither does Ken.
Talking about Ken's lack of genitalia. Didn't foresee it going this way.
You never know.
You
never know what you're walking into. Might be a trap.
Might be.
Fooled him again, didn't we, Josie? Well, I started on one route doing my research for this and ended up on a different one. Because I looked up, you know, ridiculous divorce cases, contentious divorce cases, and for the most part, they're just sad.
Yeah.
They're not really funny, and they're not really sad. So, but what did catch my eye was the history of divorce. And the history of divorce looked much more interesting than hearing people arguing about refrigerator space. So, it says the most celebrated divorce case in history, you know what it is?
Diana and Prince Charles?
No.
Oh.
Goes back further.
What's that?
Right country. Henry VIII.
Oh, yeah, when he basically wasn't allowed to be divorced. So
right.
He said, I'll start a new church.
Versus Pope Clement VII. The battle began in 1527 when Henry tried to force the Pope into annulling his marriage to Catherine of Aragon, who had failed to provide him with a male heir. Determined to make the younger and prettier Anne Boleyn his wife, Henry finally broke with Rome in 1533 and declared himself the head of the new church, the Church of England. The collateral damage from Henry's unilateral decision was a way of life that stretched back for more than 1,000 years. Gone forever was not just a system of patronage or the ancient rites, but the vast network of religious schools, hospitals, convents, and monasteries that maintained the social fabric of the country. Now, it said that Henry's marriage to Anne led to precisely one divorce in 1552. The term was not even used again until 1670.
Wow.
In fact, while Protestant Europe was beginning to embrace the idea that there could indeed be justifiable reasons for ending a marriage, in other words, up to that point, when you were married, that's it, bud.
Yeah.
There ain't no more marriages. England actually made a lurch backwards. Not only did Henry VIII's new church come out against divorce it under any circumstances, but it also far outstripped the Catholic Europe in the restrictions on granting of annulments. So it says the Church of England's
backfired on him.
Well, yeah, it said the Church
fooled him again, didn't we, Josie?
The Church of England's resistance to divorce was so strong that the only route to a divorce was via an act of Parliament. It had to go to Parliament to get a divorce granted, a law that was voted through by both houses. Not surprisingly, very few people had the means or inclination to expose their private unhappiness to the press, the public, and 800-odd politicians. When a divorce law was finally enacted in 1857 and the floodgates were opened, the number of divorces in English history shot up to 324.
Wow.
That was it for the whole country.
That's not a lot.
Only four of those 324 cases were brought by women. A husband needed to prove adultery to obtain a divorce. By contrast, a wife was required to prove adultery and some other especially aggravating circumstance to have the same grounds. Over the years, women learned that brutality, rape, desertion, and financial chicanery did not count.
Really?
In fact, Parliament seemed hard-pressed to say what did. I'll know it when I see it.
When was this?
This was in, it was after 1857 when they changed that law.
Wow.
It says, in fact, Parliament seemed hard-pressed to say what did. This one lady, Jane Addison, won on the basis of Mr. Addison's adultery and incest with her sister in the marital home. So that counted. So she got her divorce.
That'll do it.
Before that successful suit, the best a woman could hope for was a legal separation. Such arrangements were under the jurisdiction of the church courts. Litigants of either sex could sue for separation on the basis of life-threatening cruelty or adultery. Women who obtained a divorcium a mensa et thoro. That's a Latin words.
Uh-huh.
Separation from bed and board is what that means, could live apart from their husbands, often on an allowance fixed by the court. The process was expensive and torturous, hence there were only a few dozen cases a year.
That was through church court?
Yeah, and at the end, no matter what the grounds for the separation, a wife was still required to be chaste and obedient to her husband. So they could separate, but by God, she better keep to herself. Unless there were truly extenuating circumstances, she could expect to lose custody of the children, too.
Wow.
So in those days,
that's
it all...
That's horrible.
Well, look at who ran everything.
Yeah.
So, I mean, the men had everything stacked in their favor because they made all the laws.
Yeah.
The women were their property in those days, basically.
Yeah. I used to sing songs, too.
The women sang songs?
No, the men.
Oh, the men did?
I said, I'm Henry the Eighth, I am. Henry the Eighth, I am.
I don't think that came about till the 60s or the 50s anyway. I remember that song, though.
I don't know. That's all I remember of it.
Henry the Eighth, I am, I am. I don't know what it had to do with yams.
It's pretty sweet.
Let's see here. In 1561, Wilmot Berry of Devon requested an annulment on the grounds that her husband John was physically incapable of consummating the marriage. The examining midwives agreed that Mrs. Berry was a virgin, and a physician testified that a kick from a horse had left Mr. Berry with just one testicle the size of a tiny bean. That the court duly granted an annulment. Unfortunately, on his release from Wilmot, John married again and fathered a son. Matters came to a head when the next in line to inherit Barry's estate challenged the validity of the annulment and tried to have the son proclaimed illegitimate. The suit ultimately failed. The embarrassment caused by the Berry case led to a far stricter interpretation of the rules, including the new stipulation that if ex-husband suddenly found his potency, that the annulment became invalid. Nevertheless, in 1613, France's Countess of Essex and her family cited impotency in their nullity suit against the Earl of Essex. As the Countess's father put it, the Earl had no ink in his pen. Essex did not dispute the fact that the marriage had never been consummated, but eager to avoid dishonor and humiliation, he claimed that the difficulty was only with Francis. Aristocratic society did not know what to make of the case. Meanwhile, Francis had fallen in love with King James I's favorite courtier, the Earl of Somerset. She was desperate to marry him and prepared to do anything to win her case, which was a dangerous state of affairs that came back to haunt her.
Sounds like a dangerous liaison.
It is. France's lawyers believed they had found a solution in the form of an obscure pronouncement by the 13th century Saint Thomas Aquinas. Mm-hmm. Now, they're really digging. According to Aquinas...
It's well-settled law.
According to Aquinas, a man could be rendered temporarily impotent if witchcraft were involved.
Oh.
The Earl of Essex claimed Francis's lawyers had been the victim of malevolence by a person or persons unknown, and an annulment was therefore possible with honor intact for all. Few people were taken in by the Aquinas argument, and certainly not the Archbishop of Canterbury, who headed the panel of 10 judges, but Francis and Somerset had a powerful ally in the form of the king. The suit was granted by a majority vote, and the couple was married in December 1613 in the society wedding of the year. However, this was not the end of the story.
Oh.
2 years later, the king received a letter that he could not ignore. It accused Francis of having poisoned Sir Thomas Overbury, one of the loudest critics against the annulment, who conveniently died just 10 days before the court decision. If that were not damaging enough, Overbury had died while a prisoner in the Tower of London, sent there on the orders of the king. Behind the obvious scandal lay a possible conspiracy that reached all the way to the throne. Suspects were rounded up with bewildering speed. Francis was arrested and pleaded guilty to attempted murder. The disgraced couple was permanently banished to the country, where they lived out their days in bitterness and mutual recrimination.
Wow.
So how about that? So they tried to scam the system by coming up with this thing where the witchcraft made him temporarily impotent.
See, family law makes people crazy.
It does. It does make them crazy.
So, so much so, they poisoned somebody.
Let's see. In 1707, Barbara Villiers, one of Charles II's favorite mistresses, was rescued from years of misery after she discovered that her husband of 2 years was already married. Barbara had long been pensioned off with a handsome allowance and the title of Duchess of Cleveland when at the age of 64, that's not Ohio.
I thought that was LeBron James. Isn't he the Duchess of Cleveland?
He's a king.
That's right. I'm sorry.
She fell for a man 10 years younger named Robert Beau Fielding. Well, she married him on November 25th, 1705, despite his reputation as one of London's worst rakes. He was a rake and a rogue.
A rakish.
Yes.
He was a scofflaw.
But what Barbara did not know was that 2 weeks earlier, Fielding had married Anne DeLow, a widow with a fortune. Fielding kept the deception for about 6 months until he discovered that an even greater deception had been practiced on him. Anne DeLow was actually Mary Wadsworth, a friend of the real Anne DeLow, hairdresser. Fielding turned his rage on the Duchess of Cleveland, beating her so badly that she jumped through a window to escape his violence. She brought a successful suit against him in December, by which time he had already run through a great deal of her money and seduced her granddaughter, leaving her pregnant with his son.
Wow.
What a scandal, huh?
What a rake.
Yeah, he was a rake.
He sounds like a bit of a cad as well.
Says that the ironic thing about the execution of Anne Boleyn, who, of course, he had her executed.
Henry VIII.
Right. Going back to the original part of the story. Is that it would have been easier to kill her than it was to achieve the divorce. Contrary to popular belief, Henry VIII did not divorce any of his wives. He had sought an annulment from Catherine of Aragon, which he finally awarded to himself after the Pope's continued refusal. And when it came to Anne's turn, Henry took the easy route by having her found guilty of treason. 2 days before her execution, he became anxious and ordered his bishops to decree an annulment as well. Henry did not like to think of himself as a wife killer. If Anne Boleyn was guilty of starting any sort of a trend, it was in adding new significance to the line, "Till death do you part."
He's kind of a belt and suspenders kind of guy.
He was?
Yeah, we want to make sure, like, well, you know, we want to make really sure.
Well, he accused her of treason so that he could kill her, but then he was worried about, man, killing my own wife for treason? I better annul it first, so then at least I'm not killing my wife. But, so that was all English, and so I thought, well, what about America? And it says that the idea of divorce really didn't hit America until around the 1820s and 1830s. It became increasingly common for Americans to use legal ambiguities to dissolve their marriages, using what was called omnibus clauses in the 1800s to persuade courts to liberate them. Divorces were legally allowed with proof of physical cruelty and adultery, but the omnibus clauses legalize divorce in all cases where the court, in its discretion, thinks it's just and reasonable.
Yeah.
It's
kind of like an equitable type argument.
Yeah. And the idea of divorce continued to spread throughout the country, and certain states used the vagueness of the omnibus clause to entice new residents by promising them easy divorces. Throughout the second half of the 19th century, the divorce rates continued to rise as marriage and divorce laws changed. By 1867 is the first year that national marriage and divorce data became available. And for the next few decades, Americans continued to try working around loopholes in what was called a really weird legal system. Fault-based divorce laws required specific grounds for divorce, and the rule known as the Clean Hands Doctrine necessitated that the complaining party couldn't have done anything contributory to the problem.
Right.
There was a case in Oregon in the 1930s where the father had a violent temper, but the wife had thrown things at him too. So since neither party had clean hands, the court, in all their wisdom, ruled they can't divorce. So they had to stay there and keep throwing things at each other and everything. By the 1950s, however, there was an entire legal industry set up to make a mockery of these laws. For example, in Illinois, couples could get divorced if a witness could see the handprint of a slap on someone's cheeks, which led to many a witness claiming as much with or without an actual sighting. Eventually, jurists figured it was time to stop making divorce such an adversarial process, and in 1969, Ronald Reagan, the governor of California and himself a divorcee, signed the state's Family Law Act, introducing the concept of irreconcilable differences.
Yeah, and that's basically, when you talk about divorces, that's what divorces pretty much are.
Mm-hmm.
Irreconcilable differences.
Right.
I mean, there can be issues where basically you say some sort of cruelty or issues like that, but for the most part, irreconcilable differences is what all are based on.
Yeah. But I mean, it wasn't until like the 1960s where that finally, that concept of if two people don't want to be together, why would you deny them doing that? I mean, and of course, they don't have to live together just because they're married, but you're still saying, well, you can't go out and marry somebody else.
Yeah.
You know? So...
And the right to marry is a fundamental right.
Yeah. So it's kind of hard to believe that it took that long before people figured out it's not a good idea to keep people together that don't want to be together and will actually do harm to each other in some cases.
Yeah. It's like, why are we doing this? It doesn't make much sense.
No.
Well, I think that's going to bring us to...
Legal briefs.
So legal briefs is the part of the show where I go over different legal terms we talked about and see if Tommy can remember what they were.
Maybe.
We went over a... metric butt ton of legal terms today.
Oh, man.
There was a metric butt ton. There's a bunch of them, don't you think?
Yeah. So seemed like it.
I mean, the thing about family law, it's a very interesting area of law. And there's a lot of ins and outs of it. And I think there's just a lot of issues. It's very interesting. There's a lot of arguments to be made and different things to look at. But I'll tell you, I don't like doing it. Even though it is somewhat intellectually stimulating, just the practice of it is just dehumanizing with people. It's just high stress all the time.
I mean, it's bad enough having to deal with your own personal problems, but having to listen to other people's personal problems, it's just embarrassing.
Yeah, and that's one of the things, too. It's like a lot of attorneys probably look at it this way. If I'm doing a divorce, if I have to listen to your problems, you're going to pay me to listen to your problems and work through this because there's no other way around it. I mean, you might feel sorry for clients and things like that, but at the end of the day, you're the one taking it home on your conscience as well.
That's right.
Because it's super hard to distance yourself from family law issues, I think.
Yeah, it's always sad. I mean, even if the people don't get along, it's still sad. Here was people that were together and thought they were in love and didn't work out.
Yeah.
Looking for love in all the wrong places.
Looking for love. That was Eddie Murphy doing Buckwheat, singing the classics from Saturday Night. Yeah, as I've become an older lawyer and practicing more, I've become better at kind of distancing myself from the family law issues. Probably, 10 years ago, I would drive myself crazy on these cases. But now anymore, I've kind of not mellowed out a little bit, but I probably just deal with them a little bit better than I used to. So yeah. I can handle doing them. I don't really like to.
You've seen more. You've seen it all. Just like that insurance commercial there. We've seen it and we've done it.
That's right. All right, so what is the difference between community property and equitable distribution?
Community property says everything's going to be split 50-50, whereas equitable distribution, you go down through and list each of the things that are involved there and how they came about in the marriage and things like that.
Now, I gave you my theory about the pots.
There's three pots.
Why don't you explain the three-pot theory to me?
Well, in
I've been waiting for this one.
In the community one, everything goes in one big pot, then it's divided up from there.
Yeah.
In the equitable one, you got a he pot and a she pot.
Yep.
And he puts his stuff in the he pot, and she puts her stuff in the she pot, and then the rest of the stuff is divided up.
Well, you kind of skipped a step.
Oh, you throw everything in the big pot, and then take your stuff out and put it in your little pot.
That's right. And
okay.
Then whatever's left over in the big pot then gets split equitably.
Okay.
So that's the three-pot theory.
Three pots, and then the guy's left without a pot to pee in.
Yep. Nobody has a pot to pee in. Everybody's unhappy. Where does alimony originate from? Do you remember?
It originates from hummus law.
Hummus law?
Yeah, way back then, from the Romans to the Mexicans to Trump's wall.
It was
and into California.
It was hummus law in the case of Chick v. Pease.
Hammurabi's or something, isn't it? Something like that.
A little bit of lemon and a little bit of garlic. Now, there's different types of alimony. So let me see if you can remember what all the different types are. There's separation alimony. What's that?
Well, that means that's what you pay them temporarily until you get the divorce settled.
Yeah. Sometimes it's called temporary alimony, too.
Yeah.
Rehabilitative alimony.
That's like somebody says, hey, I got to go back to school for 2 semesters. So if you can give me this much money to support me while I do that, then I won't need it after that.
Here's a softball. Permanent alimony.
Well, that's paying that until she remarries or dies.
Or he remarries or dies.
Yeah.
Yeah. You got to open your mind here a little bit, Tommy.
I'm telling you, I'm stuck back in the 50s and 60s.
Yeah, you are. You're Tommy the 8th, you are. Tommy the 8th, you are. Reimbursement alimony.
Reimbursement alimony. Well, I guess that would be if somebody paid something and you got to reimburse them through alimony.
Yeah, an example of that might be if, like, you basically paid for them to go to school. And you paid room and board, you paid their tuition, you paid all that stuff. Then they'd have to pay that back. Okay. And then lump sum alimony.
Well, that's like, instead of paying them something every month, you just say, look, here's $50,000, we'll call it even. And you don't have to pay them anything else. So they take their lump sum and walk away.
That's right.
Usually that's in some of the bigger ones, and it's like several million dollars. There was one that I read about, and it was like, here's your $30 million that you get for walking away or whatever.
Probably be a pretty good attorney fee doing a $30 million divorce like that.
Yeah, I would think so.
Yeah.
At least 10%, right?
I don't know about 10%, but I imagine if they're fighting over that much money, there's people going to be fighting about it tooth and nail.
Yeah.
The one interesting thing, and that's pretty much, that does it for legal briefs. Good job.
Why, thank you. Now I can get divorced, huh?
Yep. No.
Now I know enough to do it. I didn't know enough before.
We wouldn't be related anymore.
Oh, well, that's true. We got to keep Mary in there to keep us together, huh?
That's right.
Otherwise, who's going to go watch the game with me tomorrow?
Exactly. Go herd. So, when we're talking about divorces, a lot of times, a lot of the divorces you see, people don't have attorneys, first of all. And most Supreme Courts publish different forms so people can kind of do it themselves and try to figure things out themselves. And I would say most divorces are without attorneys. And they go into the court and the judge kind of gives everybody a divorce, basically. There's not a lot of property split up. A lot of people basically just have a lot of debt and not much assets.
Right.
And that's honestly probably the bulk of divorces that happen. Unfortunately, as you're arguing about debt and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And people that are arguing about debt and don't really have much money actually can't afford attorneys to argue about it. So
correct.
A lot of times, I would say that's the bulk of what you see in domestic cases.
I'd be throwing good money after bad.
Yeah, it doesn't make any sense. Why would you hire an attorney and pay them money to fight about something that's not worth anything anyway? So. Mm-hmm. But they do, a lot of different courts publish forms and things like that, and they try to make it very accessible for people, because, and I think that's a good thing too, because it shouldn't be so hard to get divorced. If you basically come to an agreement about everything with your soon to be ex-spouse.
Then why have to get a lawyer? Complicate it.
Exactly. It doesn't make any sense. And so I think there's a push for that. And, you know, it's a good idea to always have a lawyer on your side if you can, to make sure you're not hurting yourself or anything like that. But at the same time too, you kind of know what's fair and what's right. So,
yeah. And the judge will ask you, you sure you're all right with this? You understand this is the way it's going to be?
Yeah. And it's like, well, they are pointing a gun at me underneath the table, but sure.
Well, you know what they say. Marriage is a 3-ring circus.
It is.
An engagement ring, a wedding ring, and suffering.
Thanks to everybody for listening. And thanks to MCRB for use of their song, Doctor, Lawyer, Indian Chief.
And thanks to the McElroy Stable of Podcasts for the use of their recording studio. Their podcasts include Mabim Bam, Sawbones, and Still Buffering, as well as many other fine offerings. And please, take the time to rate and review us on iTunes, especially if you liked us. If you didn't, well, then not so much.
You're not supposed to say that.
You always edit that out, though, right?
Usually. Good. This has been Court Appointed. I'm Mike Meadows, your co-host. I'm a lawyer and a dude.
And I'm your other co-host, Tommy Smurf, and I'm just a dude.
Thanks for listening.